Hi guys, today in the corner we have Josh Menko here. He is an editor for commercial and narrative projects. I'm your host, Zena Wood, and welcome. Hey Josh.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for being here.
No worries. It's a pleasure.
Yes, it's a beautiful sunny day.
Yeah, great to be inside.
So much of our industry.
Yeah.
Beautiful days and then we're inside.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I guess we'll just get started with how you got started with editing.
Okay. So I used to go to summer camps and then it was like for kids. And then during dinner, after dinner, like the staff would do skits for the kids. And traditionally, like we would also shoot stuff on VHS cameras. But I remember loading the stuff into this really janky, cheap software and putting together my first cut ever. And just like being amazed by the effect that I'd created, like continuous reality in the computer. It started off as like a hobby and a passion. And then after high school, I decided to study law. Which was a mistake. I didn't know before I started, but after 3 months of not studying law and mainly getting high, I'm not gonna lie about it, I was like 18. It made no sense to study law for me. I decided to quit and tell my parents, like, I think I want to pursue this video
amazing
thing. My parents were like, are you sure? is this a good idea, like the creative industry? That's like where that story started.
Yeah, that's amazing. So yeah, you speak about this like magical feeling that you felt with being able to mold reality or mold a story. Do you could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, of course. Well, before I started working in this industry, and when I speak to friends or whatever, I realized that a lot of people don't understand what goes on a film set and in a cutting room. People don't realize, I mean, they do realize in a way, but they don't fully realize that it's all separate takes, different angles, maybe even shot on different sort of different days. They kind of just think that a scene plays out and the camera is there. So first of all, people don't understand that's part of constructing reality, just like putting that together to a coherent like piece of time. So that was really cool to me initially, like, oh, wow, I can just build up this world. But now, like later on, when I gained more experience, like the fact that you can manipulate how characters interact, like, do I interrupt you or do I leave a long gap between every interaction? Like that makes it really awkward.
Yeah.
You know, do I cut out certain lines where people like mentally skip a beat? Which makes it interesting for the viewer, and those sort of things are just really, I mean, it's just super powerful. You're like God of this mini universe.
For sure. And with that comes a lot of responsibility as well. I mean, I know we spoke about, you know, the like ethics behind manipulating certain things. And as many of us had to do when we started out, like working in reality TV, for instance, or things like this, especially at the time when reality TV was so popular and in the beginning. I know that you also have some history with that. And how did you navigate that boundary of like manipulating emotion, but keeping it to a certain level of integrity, or was it not like possible?
Initially, I wasn't protecting any integrity. I was just trying to gain experience and I was doing what was being asked of me.
Yeah.
So I did, for instance, a show called Models in Cape Town at a really fun company where I started off, and they were like really good to me, but I did a lot of reality TV for them. And they were always pushing to manipulate, to make to make stuff more entertaining. I mean, it's not out of the ordinary. It's like what every reality production would do. And it's like very easy in editing to make someone look more stupid or make a situation more awkward. And I guess just anything goes. I did it, but first of all, I quickly started realizing that reality TV just wasn't my passion. It wasn't making me tick. And also I was getting more and more like ethical objections to basically puppeteering these people, making them look stupid or whatever. So I had some concerns when it came to that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. So I know, like, when my friends watch something who aren't in the industry, for instance, they will be very excited when they notice a continuity error. Ah. And when they see that, it's like one of the first times that they notice the edit, especially if the editor was doing a good job.
Yeah.
So could you elaborate a little bit on just continuity and
yeah,
how you see it?
Well, I would advise your friends who spot like a single continuity mistake to like tell them maybe to focus on the right part of the frame for like 5 minutes and not on where your attention is being drawn and see what you notice.
Yeah.
I mean, films and series are full of continuity mistakes. When I did my first series, I was inexperienced. The director was inexperienced and the lead role, who also wrote and directed the series, were super inexperienced. When we were in the cutting room, continuity was one of the things we were focusing on the most.
Yes.
Like two extremes. Like if someone was eating a sandwich and in one shot she was like this and in the other shot she had her index finger up, the director would be sitting next to me like after affixing an index finger.
That's amazing.
And we felt that was the most important thing in the world.
Yes.
And spent a lot of time on it. And I learned that continuity does not matter at all.
Yeah.
It's you learn how to redirect people's attention to certain parts of the screen, or emotionally you engage them in something that makes it so that they don't notice.
One thing I would love to know is, how do you keep up with like the constantly evolving technology of the software that you use for editing?
I guess for me, it's not that relevant to keep up with technical stuff. As long as it works, it's fine.
Yeah.
I mean, I am keeping a close eye on AI.
Yeah.
I'm really curious to see where that's going to take us and how that changes like the workload or...
For sure.
Creative input for us.
Yes. What are Josh Menko's AI predictions?
Oh, I don't know. I think for like generic stuff, AI could potentially replace an editor altogether. I think in documentary and drama editing, AI may be able to replace like a part of the assembly cut, but not, it couldn't replace an editor altogether. I mean, famous last words, pretty sure I'll will be fossils in 5 years. No, I mean, what would be cool is like, if I could give AI my script and my rushes and say like, hey, do 4 or 5 assembly cuts for me. Do one fast paced, do one in the style of Wes Anderson, do one like this. And then like the AI would just spit out 5 versions from which you can choose and pick. I mean, that would be amazing.
Totally.
Other than that, I don't know. I'm also a bit scared for AI. Mm. Like, are we going to be replaced? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, ideally, I'm hoping that it's going to be a great collaboration.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, I mean, AI is such a big extension of us as humans, you know? Yeah. So I'm really hoping that it'll be a wonderful collaborative venture.
Yeah, and that we don't get like held as in the 2001 Space Odyssey.
Exactly.
Or like all screwed.
Yes, so let's hope for that.
Yeah.
So you do narrative and commercial.
Yeah, correct.
And could you tell us a little bit about the differences that you experience, and also, for instance, if you were just doing commercial or if you're just doing narrative, how that would feel for you?
Yeah. So I like to balance the two, because they differ quite significantly. Like drama productions are, it's a long run. It's very fatiguing. You're very involved. I always like, my analogy is always like carrying a baby, you know, it's like a long process. It's tiring. And then like delivering the baby is tough and it takes a lot, but also it gives you a lot because you've put in so much and the results are like worthwhile usually, and it's great. But then it's really nice to alternate that with commercial, because I'm a bit more detached with commercial work. It's more fast paced. There's less individual responsibility for the editor, because the teams are usually there are a lot more people involved in the editing process. Whereas in fiction, it's like you and the director for 3-4 months straight. So there's a lot of weight on your shoulders. So those are the differences. But then again, like editing is whatever I'm doing, there are always similarities. Like you're always telling a story, trying to convey an emotion or a message. And the underlying principles are always the same, whether you're doing a commercial, documentary, an infomercial, a horror film.
Yeah.
Like, you always use the same skill and tool set in doing your work. So that's how they are similar.
Exactly. Yeah. And I can imagine that, you know, doing commercial and narrative gives you a good work-life balance as well, because they have different challenges and different things that they ask from your your life.
Well, don't ask my girlfriend about my work-life balance. If you want
always, right?
If you want a healthy family life, don't go into this industry. Like, trust me.
No, only one side of the story.
It's getting better now. No, but typically commercials will screw up my work-life balance.
Yeah.
Because the stakes are high. Also, the fees are higher. So people are very demanding. Like, at 6 o'clock, you can't say, okay, I have to pick up my daughter. Bye-bye. That's not accepted. So commercial work tends to be more demanding, like when it comes down to the nitty gritty, like hours and involvement and stuff.
Yeah.
And fiction is more, because it's more spread out, you can balance your life a bit more.
This is an interesting topic, because do you not feel that it's the producer's responsibility to relay to the client that you work from 9 till 6?
Yeah.
And that's it. But like on Tuesdays, you can maybe work from 4 till midnight or whatever. But I, as a producer, I feel like that's definitely my responsibility to keep the crew healthy and being able to live a proper life, you know?
In theory, you're right. I guess people try to do that, but it's always a problem. Like there's this chain of command, and if like the top dog barks a command down the chain, like the person under there has a decision, like, am I going to push this down the chain, or am I going to escalate this and push back? And usually people, as long as they have the chance to go down the chain, they do so. And then we're like at the bottom of the chain, not hierarchically, but we're the last people working there. So then usually it ends up with us, and then we have to be the ones to say, hey, guys, I have to leave at 6. And that's just horrible for the people above you, because they have to escalate all the way back up. And usually, my experience is that production companies usually prefer to have the people underneath just doing what they say. And then that's easier for everyone.
Yeah, I've had that experience as well. But I do think it's so solvable, you know, because if the client and the production team is educated on what goes into, for instance, your work, and knows, for instance, what kind of thing they're asking for when they ask for changes at like 5 p.m.
Yeah.
You know, it feels to me that it's quite a doable shift to just have a more aware team, like a team that has just more understanding of actually the entire process and what goes into your process, for instance. And it feels that, you know, then it's much easier to keep everyone happy and healthy on a production.
I'm glad I'm not a producer, because that would be, I mean, I can imagine that's very hard to do sometimes. You have to be very diplomatic about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's definitely a big part of the navigation of the job, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's getting, I feel like it is getting healthier.
Yeah.
When I started off, all editors used to smoke, drink a bunch of coffee, work in edit suites without windows.
Yeah.
I seriously can't remember the last time I saw anything like that.
Yeah, same. Also, when I started, the same thing. And production was really quite unhealthy, and sets were as well, and people working in them. But there's been such a big change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is very good.
Which is great. Yeah. Yes. We're going to live longer.
Yay.
So you worked on a short film that won a Golden Calf. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Could you please elaborate on this wonderful award?
Yeah, for sure. So this was with a director I worked with a few times. He's called Jan Verdijk. He's a really cool, he's a unique maker in my opinion. And he always does like very macabre, dark, sort of bordering comedy, horror, thriller stuff. And this was a project out of the Film Fonds, Dutch government subsidized film money thingy. It's called Lockdown Cinema. So it was after a year of COVID, they had like a grant for films that thematically dealt with disease and lockdown and that kind of stuff. Yeah. And he wrote a short film about two girls in the midst of like a super crazy pandemic, like sort of a zombie thing. That two small girls are trapped in a huge villa and they've managed to become like self-sustaining with water and that kind of stuff. Only their food is running out. And then a stranger comes up to a window in a full hazmat suit and asks to be let in. And then there's like this long interaction where it's like, can we trust him? Can we not? So this was like thematically, it was very on point. And then it just it went from there. It got selected for the film festival on the long list. And then I thought like, yeah, but I mean, we won't be nominated. Then we got nominated. And then like, I was pretty sure we wouldn't win it. And then we were at the ceremony and they called out the name of our film. It's called A Panzer, by the way, which translates to Shielded. You can see it on Vimeo.
Nice.
And I mean, I was just super duper proud. Like I had said the year before, like my 3-year plan is either to win a Golden Calf for editing or to be involved in a production that goes on to win a calf. And like a year later,
that's amazing.
I'd sort of done it.
You manifested it.
Yeah, I guess.
Very nice.
Yeah,
nicely done.
I was super super proud of it.
Yeah.
Still am. And it was a very cool thing to cut.
Yeah.
I think we spent a very long time on it. It was like a 20-minute film,
yeah.
3 or 4 shooting days, which would normally like take 8 days. But this director is very demanding mm-hmm. and a perfectionist. I think we must have spent like 25 days cutting it, if I'm not mistaken. This guy is the most involved you can have a director.
Wow.
So,
but yeah. He's also... I'm sure he also has a lot of respect for what you're doing, right?
So oh, yeah,
it's
yeah.
just like his presence is there a lot and like...
Yeah, definitely.
Conversations are happening.
Yeah, 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 for yeah. sure. It's very satisfying.
Yeah.
Like we're used to, I think, especially in the Netherlands, to work on a budget and on time constraints. And he will just take all the time that he needs, which can be... Sometimes it's frustrating when people do that. But if you look at the end result and think like, ah, if we had spent 6 days cutting this thing... It wouldn't have won a calf. I mean, I couldn't do a project like that one after the other.
Yeah.
Because it's too, like, you're too emotionally involved and it's very tiring. But it's fun to have, like, 1 or 2 of those a year.
Yeah,
definitely. We have a feature film coming up with him in November, which I'm scared and excited at the same time. But it's going to be...
Thrilled.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun, for
sure.
Oh,
incredible. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Yeah. So when you were in the editing process for Panzer,
yeah,
you know, you mentioned you tried different things, etc. So as an editor, how do you let go of a certain cut that you felt was like really working?
Mm-hmm.
How do you let go of it to be able to try different things or maybe not the whole cut, but like parts of it that you really felt this is good, but then also being able to have the flexibility of trying a different way.
I never get attached to a cut before it's done. So I will never, ever, ever, ever start polishing a sequence or anything until we're sure it's done. Because that keeps me like a little bit detached. Like if you really polish something with sound effects and music when you're still like pretty sure you're going to switch stuff around, you always try to cling to that, oh, you know, that one... beat that worked really well, that one glance or whatever, but
yes.
It's all irrelevant in the larger picture. So I try to be rough. I try to cut really rough for as long as possible, and that sort of keeps me detached. Yeah, I never adhere too much value. It's like a certain thing I built.
Yeah, it's a great note.
Also because it's like you need to look at it on a macro level, like what's the whole film doing? If this is a great little edit, but in the larger arc, like it doesn't work, then, you know, you should just kill your darlings.
It's a wonderful thing to know because it's a tough thing and it seems like you've got a really good process with that for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you will have times which you disagree with the director. If you're like on the end of the spectrum where you don't give people individual freedom and you want to control everything, it must be so tiresome because you basically have to do everything yourself.
Yeah.
Rather than having a team that functions autonomously.
Exactly.
Which is the desired situation. Like, it's best for everything, like for speed, for creativity, for, I mean, the atmosphere in the whole production.
Yeah, 100% agree.
Works best.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I feel like the creative industry, when it is working like that, in its great pure form, it's such a great example, I think, for all kinds of teams, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you have egos in a production, I've experienced that sometimes on commercial projects. I mean, that's not nice. And people tend to just detach.
Yeah.
If someone is too controlling in the cutting room, I will eventually go passive because I feel like my input is not appreciated. So I'll just go passive and just be like, okay, I'll be your button bashing monkey. Just tell me what to do. Which I think is a waste of
totally.
Talent. Yeah.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. A cautionary tale.
Yeah.
So are there any lessons that you learned on your journey of being an editor individually or about the industry?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I've been doing this for 15 years now. So if you spend a lot of hours on something, you learn a lot. About the industry, I can say in Holland, it can be a tough world with really tight-knit networks. So, I mean, that can be a challenge for aspiring editors to overcome. Like your network is one of your most important assets. But I feel like once you get to know people and you put in the work, also a lot of free work, it's also a very warm world to be a part of with a lot of cool and nice people. It can just be steep to get into it. Like, I remember after I did my first fiction series, which was pretty big actually, I remember thinking like, and now I will be welcomed with open arms by all the major production houses, and then just like crickets and silence. So that was a tough realization. So that's what I learned about the industry. I think the biggest individual lesson that I learned and that I still have to remind myself of every time I work, is that you have to recognize and respect your own creative process. I think many people working in the creative industry deal with insecurities. At least I do. I have a huge a case of imposter syndrome. Like every time I deliver a project, I'm like, oh, thank God nobody found out. I don't know what I'm doing. And that was really hard to deal with in the beginning. Like, I didn't know what I was doing. It was just sort of falling together and ending up as a working thing. And through the years, I learned to really recognize and analyze my own creative process, which is I always start off putting something together that's just completely horrible and crap. And that's that assembly cut is for no one's eyes but my own. And that's a starting point for me to build on, because then I can see like, okay, what's not working, and I will build on that. But when I was like super inexperienced, that would make me so insecure, seeing that first cut and being like, oh my God, I can't do this. I'm just horrible at this. Wow. And still, like every time I start on a project, I'll still have a bit of that same feeling when I see my assembly cut and just go, oh, this sucks so bad. But I've learned like to recognize that's just the way my process works.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not the best conceptual thinker from the get-go. The conceptual thinking will grow as my timeline develops. So I won't be a guy that sees a script, sees a footage and goes like, I'll do this, that, and then bam, it's there. No, I sort of clay my edits together. And I've learned to accept and respect that and trust that that'll take my work to good places where people are satisfied. I don't know if that's the same for every editor, everyone in the creative industry, but everyone has a process. And I think it's good to be respectful of that. Not try to copy other people's processes, which you look up to, but just see what works for you.
Yeah, that's incredible advice for sure.
Yeah.
For aspiring editors as well. I think what's so interesting about creative jobs is that we get to see things when they're not show ready, yep. right? Like yeah. we see them in their like non-glory.
Yeah.
And we have to somehow find a way to be okay with that and to not let it distract us. And I think you've done that really well. So yeah, that's really awesome to hear.
Thanks. Yeah. No, I mean, that's can be hard showing stuff to people that can't see through like the rough edges.
Mm.
I mean, that's just stay away from it as long as possible.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's that can be hard.
So according to you, what is the role of an editor? Just blanket term, your interpretation.
The role of an editor is, I always like to analogize, I think it's like a chef. Like, and all the people working before that are like people who write the recipe, the farmers who grow the crops, and the butcher and whatever, the dairyman. Everybody works to deliver a good product, and they might have ideas about how that product is used because there's like there's a menu written, but then it ends up in the kitchen and you're like, ah, this menu is not going to work as we planned it because the milk is sour or the apples aren't ripe yet. And then, so the cutting room is literally like the kitchen for me, where you are together with the director, the chef, and you decide like, okay, we still have to turn this into an edible meal. So you might have to change some things around.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's basically, if you're going back to like literal film terms, it's like a rewrite. So you write a script, and the script is usually rewritten on set by actors and directors who are like, ah, maybe cut that out, switch it around, do that a bit more like this.
Poor writers.
Yeah. And then in the cutting room, you get like another rewrite. And it's just an extremely important part of the process, the offline edit. People don't realize how like powerful that process is and how much gets decided in the cutting room.
Totally.
I think it's like in film, it's one of the most important positions that's also the most anonymous.
Yeah.
People don't see you. You're behind the screen. 99% of the world doesn't understand what you're doing.
Yeah.
And I'm actually okay with that. What's really weird about being an editor is you get very intimate, or I get very intimate with my characters.
Yes.
Because you're like looking at them for months on end. You get to know their like subtle twitches that reveal insecurity or satisfaction with a take.
Yeah. So,
like, you really know people, and then you run into them on the street. And I go into like this, hey, how are you? And you can see people like, who are you?
You have this form of knowledge of them that they do not have for you.
No, and that is the weirdest experience ever. And it happens to me all the time.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Where you just greet people and they're like, who are you?
I just got an idea for a script.
Ah.
An editor gets kidnapped by like the CIA to be like a profiler.
Oh, definitely.
Yes.
No, editors.
Anyone want to write that?
That's a great idea, because we really do understand psychology in subtleties.
Yes.
Like in pauses or brevity in speaking, or when people skip a beat mentally, like that sort of stuff. That's all like very subtle psychology.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, that's also really cool about our craft.
Yeah, for sure.
That script would work.
Yes. Yes. Perfect. Let's get it written. but you mentioned anonymity, and I know there's also like, of course, there's the editor as well, who you can see has a hand in a film because they get recognized and you can kind of start telling, especially if you're into editing and watching editors' careers, you can tell that this editor worked on a project. So if you could just elaborate between the two versions, basically.
If I want to differentiate between like two main forms of editing, there's like invisible editing and visible editing, I guess.
Yeah.
When invisible editing is done well, you just lose yourself in the continuous reality. And it even happens to me when I'm watching a film, it just goes by. I don't watch the edit. Unless it's badly done or badly written or acted, then I will start like looking at lighting and edit choices. But that's a bad sign. And then there's like really visible editing, like the film that just won the Oscar, Everything Everywhere All at Once, where it's like so elaborate and technical that it really takes center stage. I mean, that's super cool. It's also dangerous because you're putting a lot of emphasis on the edit. So it needs to be good.
Exactly. Like
proper good. But if done well, that's amazing. But in 95% of cases, I think editing is and should be invisible.
For sure.
That's the whole point of it. I would recommend anyone aspiring to be an editor to read Walter Murch's book.
In the Blink of an Eye.
In the Blink of an Eye. Yeah. I forgot most of it, but there's like this priority list of 6 points.
Yeah.
And I think continuity is like fourth or fifth on the list of important things.
Exactly.
Also, like emotion and story is on number one and two. Emotion is on number one. Also, stuff with like axes.
Yes.
Totally not important.
Yeah.
If you manage to take your audience along in for the ride, forget about that stuff. I mean, just fix it if it's annoying or it takes people out of the experience. But otherwise, it just doesn't matter.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's one of those things, like also when I was at film school, you know, we learned about continuity and stuff, and you start fixating on these like things and you're like, oh, the necklace was there and it had to be here.
Yeah.
But then afterwards, with more experience, you learn that it's about the story and all these things. You start looking at it from a whole different
point of view. Well, I mean, it is important if you're learning to understand how it works and to respect those basics, because then you can utilize those rules in your favor. Like if you want to make a scene more more manageable for your audience, like you can stick more to the rule with axes. But if you want to make it disorienting or like scary or whatever, use jump cuts, go all over axes.
You know, sometimes in film school they let you do different roles, right? To like get to know the whole process. So my first thing I had to edit, I had a scene from The Departed, and it's meant to be like a romantic dinner scene.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I just wanted to use the dolly because I was like, ooh, dolly. So I had this cut where I was like pushing in this dolly, and like the whole thing looked like a horror. Like it literally looked like they were about to murder each other.
It just changed the whole experience. Yeah.
That's not what I was trying to do. But when I looked at the edit, I was like, oh no.
What have
I done?
That's so strange. It's like there are no rules for editing, but you sort of learn to understand the grammar of editing. And I find that hard to explain to like assistants or other people. It's just something it's like a feeling. Maybe for other people, it's less of a feeling and it's more about rules. And but for me, I'm just editing. I'm like, I want to create this feeling. And then I just know these ways to achieve that. There's no set rule, like you need to go to close and then to wide. It's like speaking. Like when you speak to people, you learn how to convey emotions and nuances through timing and dynamics. And it's not something that you actively think about.
Yeah.
It's just something you've learned through your life in interacting with people, reading reactions. That's something you learn in editing as well. And the fun thing is when you're inexperienced and you do things with an intended outcome and the outcome is completely different, those are really, really valuable experiences.
Yes, it was a very good lesson. Yeah,
because now you know, like, okay, well, a slow dolly in, that's creepy.
The dolly in is creepy.
Yeah, this slider is moving from side to side. That's not creepy, right?
Well, let's hope not, because then it's going to be a very interesting corner episode. Well, yeah, Josh, thanks. It was amazing having you here on the corner, and we wish you the best of luck in your endeavors.
You guys too. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Awesome.
Okay.
Exit music.
Ba-da-da.
Ba-da-ba-da-ba.
Bye-bye.